Hey everybody, it's Ryan. Before we get going with the podcast today, I just want to share some news with all of you. A friend of mine from college named Jeff Wall died of cancer last week. He's had it for quite a few years and seemed like he'd beaten it, but it came back with a vengeance and it took him just a few days ago. His sister Lindsay was kind enough to contact me and let me know that this was going to happen, and I was very touched by that because I hadn't seen him in so long, but she saw that we commented on each other's Facebook wall quite a bit and she took the time to do that, so I thank her so much for that. I wrote a message to her, wrote one to him too. I didn't expect her to read either of them then, or to read what I wrote to him, but she said she did, and it made him smile, which made my heart soar. I think he listened to our podcast. I hope he did. He always wanted us to do Star Wars long before we ever actually did cover it. And I hope when we finally did the podcast, it was to his liking. He was a huge Star Wars fan, and unfortunately, he's not going to get to see the movie when it comes out. I miss Jeff. I always will. Definitely going to think about him when I see Star Wars. Definitely going to think about him when I watch Jays games next year, especially if they have a great season like they did this one. He was such a fan of so many things. I never met his wife or son. My sympathies to them, of course, to Lindsay, his whole family, and all of his friends. The outpouring on Facebook has been wonderful. So, we dedicate this podcast to Jeff. Let's get her going. Bye, buddy.
I see stale coffee. Listeners, are you haunted by the mediocre coffee that you get from the grocery store or your local coffee shop?
All the time.
Well, Sparkplug Coffee is here to save you. Sparkplug uses only premium Arabica beans sourced through direct and fairly traded methods. Sparkplug offers blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf, and they deliver this coffee right to your door within a week of custom roasting it right here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen, so plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100 Project
and action.
Hi there, movie freaks, and thanks for checking out the Top 122 Project, the almost finished quest to watch and review all of the movies on the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. Here's a spoiler alert for the movie with the most famous spoiler in modern history. I am Ryan Ellis, the boy who sees dead people, accompanied by my deceased therapist wife, Bev.
That's me.
Spoilers already! So the coming attraction trivia for this week's picture, with another spoiler involved here, The Sixth Sense. How many of the 13 AFI movies during the 1990s killed off the main character?
I forgot to look this up beforehand, so, off the top of my head. Pulp Fiction.
Correct.
Saving Private Ryan.
Correct.
Titanic.
Correct.
What are the rest?
You got three of the four. Not bad off the top of your head.
Oh, good, good.
Pulp Fiction, Titanic, Saving Private Ryan. So Travolta, DiCaprio, Hanks, all die. And then also, this movie, The Sixth Sense.
Oh, okay.
And we've had three in a row because Titanic was 2 weeks ago, Saving Private Ryan, and now The Sixth Sense. Okay, the Top 100 Project's 122nd title and our second to last movie. Hard to believe, we're almost done. The Sixth Sense was not even a movie during AFI's 1998 Top 100. Then was 89th in 2007 between Bringing Up Baby and Swing Time, one of Bev's all-time favorites. She'll love it forever. The Sixth Sense was first shown in an appropriate place, Philadelphia, on August 2nd, 1999. Then was released by Hollywood Pictures and Buena Vista Pictures on M. Night Shyamalan's birthday, August the 6th. Good reviews, major, major hit. For those who aren't fresh on this movie from 16 years ago, Bev, describe The Sixth Sense now with a skinny.
Don't tell me you haven't seen or at least heard about this movie. Just don't.
All right, screw it then. Skinnies are for wimps. So in a nutshell about The Sixth Sense, Spectre's wife ignores him, so he proceeds to harass troubled child.
Now I know why you were looking up synonyms for ghost.
Isn't that funny?
You went with Spectre.
Yeah. All right, so some Sixth Sense numbers. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, 85% of them liked the movie, 126 fresh reviews, 22 rotten, and 89% of audiences. The movie was such a success that it still remains 65th on Box Office Mojo's adjusted for inflation list, about $23,000 behind Dark Knight Rises. And that helped make it the second movie at the 1999 US box office. Phantom Menace, of course, was number one. But forget about box office, forget about reviews. What does Bev Ellis think about The Sixth Sense?
I think it's a very good movie. I liked it better this second time around than I expected to. The twist is cool, but there's like a legitimately solid story with some great performances holding it up there too. Haley Joel Osment is terrific, as is the often underappreciated Toni Collette, but it does not belong on this list, especially when you consider the other great films that came out in that very same year that are not represented on the list. If you're picking something just because it's popular and zeitgeisty, like Sixth Sense, you're going to choose that over The Matrix?
Whoa.
But seriously, that's really what qualifies Sixth Sense to be on the list at all. It was very popular. It was very zeitgeisty. It had some influence, but really it was just a cultural juggernaut, but not compared to The Matrix. It wasn't.
Yes, and one of my favorite years is 1999. Toy Story 2. American Beauty was a good movie that won the Best Picture Oscar.
There was also Fight Club and Three Kings and Toy Story 2 and Galaxy Quest, one of your all-time favorites, one of my all-time favorites, Election, Talented Mr. Ripley, Magnolia, American Movie, everybody's favorite documentary from the 90s, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, which I know is British and wouldn't qualify it anyway, but Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels was, without argument, a more influential movie than Sixth Sense. I think every movie looked like Lock, Stock for like the next 3 years.
Except you just made the point it can't have been nominated, so...
Not that I would even suggest that Lock, Stock should be nominated, but I feel like it's probably a more valid movie to talk about from the 90s, because at least it had a significant influence, and it also launched the career of an auteur director.
Well, in my top 20 for 1999, for whatever that's worth, The Sixth Sense wasn't even in there. It's a pretty good movie. No way should it be on this list. Are you kidding me? Not even necessarily the titles you mentioned, but the dozens we've mentioned as we've gone through this entire project. But for me personally, this movie was ruined by the fact that maybe I heard this, I don't remember specifically, but when I went in there with a friend of mine, the scene after Bruce Willis gets shot in the gut, the camera's above him, it goes to black, and then it says something like a year later, the following fall or something, and he's watching Haley Joel Osment come out of his house. I leaned over to the friend and whispered, "He's dead already." And I spent the rest of the movie analyzing. Yeah, dead there. Makes sense. Dead there. Yep. Ghost. Spectre. Yep. I wouldn't say it ruined the movie, and I get why people who didn't hear that ahead of time were, "What the wow!" When Bruce Willis finds out about it, too. That's the biggest zeitgeist you think about the whole movie. And if that's blown for you, then it doesn't really fall apart, but then the specialness is gone.
I didn't figure it out because I am actually notoriously terrible at figuring out twists in movies. I never see them coming, which delights me because I love being surprised. And I loved the movie when I first saw it. I found it super engaging. And that twist did exactly what any good twist should do, which is it made me stop and think about the movie all over again from a brand new perspective and analyze it. But, you know, I still never bothered going back to rewatch it.
Really?
No, this is the second time I've ever seen the movie when we watched it for the project. I saw it in the theaters. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It definitely gave me an animated conversation after we left the theater. And it genuinely scared me. I should mention that, too.
It's a good scare, yeah.
It scared the bejesus out of me.
Our third official horror film on the list. We've talked about this plenty when we've done horror films. Frankenstein, Psycho. Now this, we've talked about whether or not Jaws and Silence of the Lambs are also horror films. Even if they are, that's only five in the entire list. Great genre. We are going to carry on with the project when this is over. I think we've already mentioned this a few times. And next Halloween, we're going to do Horror Movie Month. We didn't do any horror movies this past October because we wanted to cover Back to the Future for October 21st and the Not My Horror Project. Next year, we'll just do all horror movies. It's one of my favorite genres. I have watched so many bad horror movies, more than any other genre, as far as a terrible-looking piece of crap that I've seen on Netflix or TV or even rented them when that was the thing to do. Because it intrigues me, this genre can be good. It Follows is a recent example of a good, scary movie that certainly freaked you out, for sure.
Oh, my God.
And it got to me a little bit, too, no doubt about it. And The Babadook. Babadook.
Don't even do that. That movie scared me so bad.
Modern examples of great scary movies. We've mentioned the torture porn movies in recent weeks. In fact, just last week, Saving Private Ryan, I kind of cut into them. I've seen all the Saw movies. I saw most in the theater. I did enjoy them. I probably should recant what I said last week as far as ripping into them, because they are enjoyable to the point. They're just not very scary. This movie is... But also, having seen it probably four times now, it didn't mess with me at all during it. It certainly didn't mess with me late that night. That's always been my gauge. The Ring and The Grudge, two movies that came out around the same time, early 2000s. Didn't like either of them enough to say, "Go see those movies. They're awesome, man. Two big thumbs up." But they stuck with me that night, and that was my test. I lived alone in a condo. The Ring, I saw that girl come on my TV, as nuts as that is. The Grudge, I wanted to strangle that stupid ghost. I wanted to legitimately strangle, not to save myself, because I was just tired of that weird noise that thing was making. Just please kill it again and get it out of my head. But then it was playing with me that night. That's what a good horror film can do. So let me ask you, because you did sleep alone that night. I had to work after we saw this movie. Did The Sixth Sense affect you later that night?
No. It did the first time I saw the movie. I'm pretty sure that it spooked me pretty bad. But because I knew the scares were coming this time, even though he really broadcasts his scares, the big setup where you know it's coming, like you know when he's in that red tent and the clothes pegs are popping, that something bad is about to happen. You know when he's in the bathroom, it's like, the only reason this scene is included is because they're going to show us something scary. Although that's the first time you actually see a ghost when he's going to the bathroom in the middle of the night. And that, oh, I remember how scary that was the first time I saw it, but it really didn't work on me the second time. What I focused on, and this is a legitimate compliment to Shyamalan, I focused on the relationships and the characters and how they grow over the course of the movie. Like, there are layers of things that you can enjoy about this film.
It's a domestic drama with ghosts. It's as much a psychological drama as a horror movie. And it's an old-fashioned ghost story at that, with very few big shocks. You mentioned the scene where the woman walks past and there's a music stinger when Cole is taking a pee. And that's a great example of the camera doesn't cut, so why is it not cutting? And then, oh my god, big scare. Didn't really affect us so much at the second viewing. But I tip my hat to him for doing it properly, and that would have messed people up back in the day when they first saw the movie in the theater. The tent scene, of course, leads us to the Misha Barton character. What I guess works about that, and you acknowledged when they show her vomiting up this crap, we don't know what exactly she's doing that for till we find out later, that that's the best scare in the whole movie.
That's the best scare of the whole 90s.
I think so, really.
Oh, yeah. And if you look up people talking about this film, everybody has to mention that scene, and everybody acknowledges that it kept them up at night.
But you're saying that didn't mess with you this time.
No. I knew it was kind of, I was really mentally prepared for it, though.
But you see, in a good scary movie, even if they telegraph the shocks, it can be just as effective, if not more so.
That's a good point.
Well, kind of like Psycho, which doesn't really have that many thrills either. The shower scene is one of the most famous in the history of movies. But beyond that, there aren't that many thrills. Of course, the ending as well of Psycho. That's very much true about Sixth Sense, too. There's as much heartbreak as there are thrills in this movie. Starting out with the murder-suicide. Donnie Wahlberg, Mark's brother. Far more famous brother, Mark Wahlberg, not on the top 100 list. But his brother Donnie is in a pretty effective role. He lost weight. In fact, I got a little bit of a skin crawly moment in that more than anything else in the whole movie because he sells it so well.
He lost over 40 pounds to be in the film, and he really puts his all into it. He really wanted to break into acting like his brother had. I'm surprised it didn't work because his performance is actually really good. Like you said, it's creepy, makes your skin crawl. He's so different from the Donnie Wahlberg that we all knew that I didn't recognize him. I remember somebody told me way later that that was Donnie Wahlberg, and I didn't believe them. He's completely a different person and such a stretch from who we knew, and a way bigger stretch than his brother's ever pulled off in any of his films, too.
And useless trivia for you, we mentioned the Saw movies a few minutes ago. He's in two of those.
Oh, yeah, that's right, he is.
As the tough cop, not as a terrified victim.
But it took him a long time to accomplish much as an actor, and you still would never call him a successful Hollywood star by any stretch.
Especially considering Mark is such a huge star. We haven't talked about the big star of this movie, Bruce Willis. Have we mentioned that name at all yet? One of the biggest stars ever in Hollywood, no matter what he's doing now, which is a lot of junk. And if you want to hear somebody rip into that guy, just listen to a Kevin Smith podcast or hear about the whole Expendable story and how easily he was replaced. He was very expendable in Expendables 3. But we did Die Hard. That was our first ever Not 100 Project movie. And now this one, of course, he's in Pulp Fiction too, so two top 100 projects, and we've covered him three times. And we'll probably do a few more movies of his before all said and done, where this podcast ends years from now. He can be a terrific actor, and this is one of the best examples of it. I am more of an Unbreakable / Signs fan. For all the flaws in Signs, that movie scared me to the point where I was gripping the seat. Like in Saving Private Ryan, I mentioned that last week. I was gripping my seat in both of those movies, ironically. Sixth Sense, not so much. But because this movie's more about just a quiet performance by him and a pretty quiet performance by Haley Joel Osment, to act with a kid who had very little experience, he was only 10 during the shooting, he's playing 9 years old, he was Forrest's son in Forrest Gump, way back when for us, and I always thought he would have been perfect in The Shining. Danny Lloyd was okay, but the way that book is written, if you have ever read the book, Haley Joel Osment, Sixth Sense, and AI era, great in AI, would have been great in The Shining. But the way that he and Willis play against each other is terrific acting. Willis never thought of as a strong actor, but he's doing excellent work with this kid.
And he's really good casting because he always, no matter what movie he's in, he's pretty stoic and chill. Like, he's always the cool guy. But you need somebody to play really straight, serious, and measured to sell all the ridiculous things that are going on in the film.
The Harrison Ford syndrome.
Yeah, actually, yeah. He's another one that does that.
You know, one of the reasons why that really applies right now, we've talked about the big twist that he was dead all along. If you look online, there's all these questions about how either Cole or Malcolm, Bruce Willis's character, didn't know that Malcolm was dead all along. Cole says at one point that they get mad, and that's when things get cold. That's why the mother who's in the kitchen, the first ghost we see, or the girl that's peeking up the soup, that's why the temperature goes way down. At the very end of the movie, when Malcolm loses his cool, where's my wedding ring? What's going on? Why are there books in front of the staircase downstairs? Is because he's finally lost his cool. Malcolm Crowe is Bruce Willis cool all the way through that movie, and that is fair continuity because he is so Mondo, if you will, that it isn't revealed he's been shot because he isn't playing as a ghost yet, and his injury, of course, is hidden, unlike somebody who got shot in the head, the boy, we see the back of his head get blown out, or the woman right towards the end who's been burned up in a fire. You can't mistake what happened to them. But they do hide it pretty well with Bruce Willis's injury. Although I always thought it was a bit of a bogus call that he's able to wear the clothes he wore on the last night he was alive. I'll get that as a ghost, much like Patrick Swayze in Ghost is wearing the clothes he wore when he died. Fine, okay, you want to go by that. He's not going to be naked. You can't do that in a movie anyway. Fine. But wearing any clothes you had on that night, including the sweater, or the overcoat, and all this other stuff, it of course hides the fact he's just wearing a dress shirt and his pants when he is shot. So it's a bit of a stretch. I don't really care that much, but it's also a bit of a cheat too, I guess, right?
It's a good point, because all the other ghosts, their injuries are really evident, so you think he would at least have the gut shot blood.
I looked. When he throws the rock through his wife's antique shop, and then she and the friend go out, what happened? What's going on? All that. And he's walking down the street. He's upset. Maybe there's cold breath. We don't see that because he's outside. But his vest is open just enough. You could have seen where his gunshot would have been. And I looked very closely and I didn't see it. But I'll give him that slack because I can't say for sure that I didn't see a small puncture wound. Had it been from the back, which is the big reveal at the end, you see the big blood on the back. That would have been a cheat.
This is so nitpicky, too. We can leave
it is, but it's the whole thrust of this movie.
Well, though. He makes the rules and he breaks his own rules, and that can be frustrating when a filmmaker does that, but it's not as frustrating when they also make a good enough movie that you're not focusing on these details until long after the movie.
I don't think he does break them. That's what I'm saying. For the fact this movie is overrated, and it certainly is that, when I read that part online, that he is not evident to Cole as being a ghost, the reasons I've just said make sense to me. The other thing the filmmakers worried was a giveaway was when the big famous line happens, I see dead people. The camera goes in a push-in to Bruce Willis's face. And they all thought in their dailies, that'll give it away. Everyone will guess that right there. But it's not like there's a scene of 12 people and then they focus on this one guy.
No, exactly.
It's He's reacting.
It's just shorthand for this is an emotional moment.
And his psychiatrist is messed up with the fact this little kid sees dead people. Well, of course he's going to react to that. Yeah. He just doesn't react with emotion. That's still important because he can't, because the world would start being like a ghost.
He's also a trained therapist, so he would be very practiced at keeping his emotions measured and listening to people without reacting.
But it's still a shocking moment, so why wouldn't you show his reaction shot? So people are wrong when they say that gives away the game. They
should and he was wrong. Like, if things gave it away, it was never that particular shot. It was, like you said, the opening scene, and people just guessing that.
When I turned to that friend, the reason why I thought this, and maybe I'd heard, I really don't remember, it's been so long, but I think it's because in movies or TV shows, somebody gets shot, the camera goes to black, and you don't see the resolution to it. It's not even addressed the next couple of minutes.
But it kind of works the other way, too. That whole scene is the setup for what he needs resolved as a character. He needs to get confidence again that he can save somebody. So you could, just as an audience member, accept that the purpose of that scene was to set up his emotional journey that he needs to take, rather than illustrating that he's dead.
Right, and his whole journey is to both help Cole and to have this closure with his wife. She doesn't have that closure, I guess you could argue, because he's not going to ever come back. But then you could argue, according to the movie's rules, that he speaks to her when she's asleep, so she somehow gets that, oh, okay, I can move on from this finally. We don't know, the movie's over, so
that's one, like, thing about the film that I found so super corny was the very convenient sleep talking. You are a sleep talker, and nothing you say ever remotely makes a shred of sense.
I would argue with you, but I was asleep. So I can't prove what I said or didn't say. Well, we're going on this whole Bruce Willis is dead thing. Our three bona fide AFI horror movies, Frankenstein and Psycho and this one, all have dead alive themes. The Frankenstein monster is a reanimated corpse, and then in Psycho, it's the taxidermied corpse of Mrs. Bates, and then Bruce Willis in this film. So I guess you have to be dead and then not dead to make an AFI top 100 list.
It is kind of a universally creepy thing to guarantee that you're just going to give your audience the heebie-jeebies. Anything about reanimating the dead in any way, whether it's ghosts or zombies or Frankenstein monsters.
Yeah, and I'm also going to connect this to last week's podcast again, Saving Private Ryan. We said that whether it's deliberate or not, All Quiet on the Western Front, which was definitely an influence on Saving Private Ryan, did not make the second list. Saving Private Ryan couldn't have made the first list, so they effectively, whether it was deliberate or not, replaced each other. Frankenstein missed the second list with this Dead Alive theme, and The Sixth Sense made the second list with this Dead Alive theme, so deliberate or not, the same thing happened with these two pictures. The Sixth Sense maybe wouldn't have happened in the first place had an executive named David Vogel not taken a chance on this one. M. Night Shyamalan had made Wide Awake, some movie I've never seen. Vogel got fired by Disney for paying $3 million to buy this script because Disney had no faith in it. And then it becomes one of the biggest hits in the history of motion pictures.
Yeah, they sold it to Spyglass, reduced the budget, and still made a fortune because they kept 12.5% of the box office receipts.
Hey, another similar theme to an upcoming movie. We just talked about the Saving Private Ryan connection to this movie indirectly. Well, Lord of the Rings next week. Miramax was indirectly involved in that one because they were going to produce it, and then they ended up selling off some rights and stuff. And I think the Weinsteins technically have credit, but not really involved. Well, there you go. Disney, in a way, is involved in The Sixth Sense, but not really directly involved.
It does have a pretty interesting backstory of how it got made, and interesting how Bruce Willis got cast, too, because a couple years before The Sixth Sense, Willis was producing and starring in a film called The Broadway Brawler, which you've never heard of for good reason, because while he was working on that film, he flipped out, fired the crew, including the director, just a few weeks into production. It derailed it so bad that it forced Disney to abandon it altogether, and it never got made. So to make up for the $17 million loss that caused the studio, Willis signed a 3-picture contract with Disney. Part of his salary would go to recouping those losses, and those 3 films were Armageddon, The Kid, and The Sixth Sense. So two of those three huge hits. Yeah. Two of those films are probably films that he should say are work that he's proud of, period.
The Armageddon, for all its faults, is fun, and it was a monster hit. It was the biggest one in 98 worldwide. It was second, I think, at the box office in America to Saving Private Ryan in 98. And The Kid did okay in 2000.
I don't remember The Kid at all.
Well, I don't either, but it did okay. I looked it up, actually, because I thought maybe that was a big hit, too. It's actually Disney's The Kid.
I couldn't tell you the first thing about it.
He encounters his younger self, and his younger self can't believe the way he's turned out. So the younger self is, you don't even have a dog!
Oh, that actually...
You would sympathize with young Rusty. Yeah, so if you're going to be forced into a contract you don't want to sign, these 3 movies, you could do worse, especially in your wallet.
Yeah, no kidding. But it sounds like he was a massive, intolerable prima donna who completely shut down a production, so probably backing up things that Kevin Smith has said about him.
Yeah, at the same point, he did Unbreakable with M. Night Shyamalan, so he must have liked working with them. He hasn't worked with them since. Bruce Willis is the unlikely TV-to-movie superstar. There's more of them now, although Bryan Cranston, for all his TV success, has not made it into being a movie superstar. George Clooney, of course, has done that.
Yeah. And much more than it used to be, TV is a perfectly valid way to break into film.
But to be a superstar, that's why I say the very unlikely TV to movie superstar.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Headlining $20 million actor, Bruce Willis is one of the few.
Unless you came from Saturday Night Live.
Sandler and Ferrell, yeah, sure. So what do you think of Bruce Willis? Because he had the small part in Pulp Fiction, effective, but not a leading player, and a bit of a jerk. This movie... Okay, here's one of the weaknesses. This is one of the reasons I was also convincing myself when I saw it that first time in the theater that I thought I was right. The movie never paints it that he's enough of a bad husband that she should be ignoring him. So he's got to play so many scenes alone or with just a young actor who's inexperienced. Not a lot of actors would be able to pull that off, especially the superstar type. Based on all that, thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs in the middle.
I know why people take his guff. Because the product at the end is great. He is a movie star. He is, like you say, that perfect kind of bland cipher, the way Harrison Ford and Keanu Reeves. Like they say about a lot of big movie stars is that they're kind of bland and charismatic at the same time because they're just there to react to what's going on. And he does that perfectly. And I've always found him just a fun guy to watch. And if he's in a movie, he's going to make it better. He may be a total jackass on set, but he's going to put more butts in the seat because he is a bona fide movie star. I like Bruce Willis.
Except he and John Cusack, if you look on Netflix, are 2 actors who've got a lot of stuff on there you've never heard of before. People want to rip into Nicolas Cage all the time about how he does such dreck and it's just for the money. But Bruce Willis and John Cusack do their share of dreck too, if you look on Netflix at least. However, Bruce Willis does have Die Hard in this movie and Pulp Fiction and some other ones. So
and
that's a pretty
good
career.
John Cusack does not have Bruce Willis's charisma.
Oh, hell no.
He does not have a screen presence.
The star either.
Yeah.
I mentioned Unbreakable a few minutes ago. A similar theme of both Unbreakable and The Sixth Sense is that helping people becomes the end game for one of the main characters. When Malcolm tells Cole, help these ghosts, listen to them, talk to them, get them through, which looks like that's what he's going to do from that point on, that seems to work. Then in Unbreakable, when Sam Jackson tells him to go find trouble because he can feel people, he's a superhero in the making, then he does that, and he saves a family in a really horrific scene, which is actually directed quite well, considering it is a horrific scene in Unbreakable. If you've seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. And he saves these poor kids, at least, from future horrific doings.
The other thing those two films have in common, and it's kind of a theme in Shyamalan's work, is that he does have a gift for approaching a well-worn genre, like a ghost movie, a superhero movie, alien invasion movie, and then making it from a strikingly intimate perspective. That is a way that his voice is unique. You make a ghost story, but the story really is about their relationship. That's the crux of the film. And Unbreakable, a lot of directors came out at this point in time, in the 90s and the early aughts, and you've got someone like Bryan Singer or Sam Raimi or Gore Verbinski who made these good smaller films and then parlayed that into a career making superhero movies. You compare their superhero movies that they made to something like Unbreakable, which may not be the world's greatest movie, but it is most certainly the most interesting and unique take on the superhero out of anything that Hollywood's made in the last 20 years.
It's an origin story that never had a follow-up.
And it does something that they don't do. It shows a perspective that they don't show. I didn't love that movie, but I was so moved and struck by the scene where he is lifting the weights. And that is how they discover that he's a superhero, because they just keep adding weight and adding weight. And it's this really lovely, intimate moment with his son. He's not saving somebody from a criminal. He's just having this quiet kind of family moment, coming to terms with something.
His relationship with Spencer Treat Clark in that film, also really well played. Another young actor he worked well with.
That's obviously another thing he has a gift for, is getting great performances out of actors, and particularly child actors, because he gets this terrific... I mean, Haley Joel Osment obviously earned all the praise. Apparently, after he auditioned, Shyamalan's reaction was, if he can't be in the movie, then I'm not even sure I want to make this movie anymore.
Wow. Well, they went the right way, because that's one of the best years ever for Best Supporting Actor nominees at the Oscars. Michael Caine won for The Cider House Rules. Good performance, more of a career achievement kind of thing. Tom Cruise, Michael Clarke Duncan, Osment, Jude Law for Talented Mr. Ripley. Christopher Plummer in The Insider. You didn't mention that one in 1999 movies.
That's because I don't like that movie.
Well, you should have mentioned it. Great performance as Mike Wallace. But seeing this again, maybe Osment was, if not the one he should have won, maybe he should have been taken even more seriously than he probably was at the time. Michael Caine had a great speech where he mentioned all the nominees, and he said to Osment about how you astound me, something like that, and you're going to do all these great things. And unfortunately, the kid really didn't do that, because he went to college, and good for him for doing that, just like Jodie Foster did. She gave up her career for many years and then came back and had such a great career after she was in Taxi Driver and whatnot when she was a young kid. And then comes back with The Accused and Silence of the Lambs and Contact and all the career she's had ever since. Osment's only getting back to movies now, working with, we say the name again, Kevin Smith.
Oh, is that right?
He was in Tusk. And he's going to be another one of Smith's movies. I forget which one. He's got a lot of them in the hopper right now.
You're one of the brave souls who saw Tusk. How was Osment in that movie?
He's fine. Not as effective as he was in this film. But he's asked to do such strange things for a child actor. I mentioned Danny Lloyd in The Shining. Nothing against that kid. He's fine. Kubrick doesn't always get the best performances out of people. What he does is he gets iconic performances out of people.
Yes.
Maybe not the most believable, but as an aficionado of that book, that kid is brilliant. Maybe no kid at the time could have pulled that role off. Maybe no kid who's acting now could have pulled that role off. But Osment at this age, he's a little older than that kid's supposed to be, granted, would have done that. I wouldn't say he's lost his talent as an older person, but sometimes it happens. I mean, look at Gary Coleman. As great as he was as Arnold on Different Strokes, he never really kept that going as he got to be an older actor.
Well, it's a story with so many child actors that they just can't parlay it into a career as an adult. And, you know, for all we know, maybe they just don't really want the stardom. They don't want to be movie stars. I think that's a really specific type of personality of somebody who can agree to the terms of the life of a film star.
Look at the kid from Game of Thrones who played Joffrey. He decided to give it up. He was always going to give it up whenever they kill off his character.
He should have done just one more project where he got to rinse everybody's brain of the impression of him as Joffrey.
Maybe he still will one of these days. He doesn't have to give it up fully forever, even though he's giving it up for now. So what'd you think about a storyline that had ESP and an early murder-suicide in it, too? Those are some heady, weird kind of elements we haven't seen in so many bland kind of movies. Okay, not bland. We've had a lot of movies in this project that might seem like they're ordinary on the outside, like a Tootsie, for example. But that movie's trying to be funny, so if it achieves that, then who cares if there's not really anything deep going on in there. But this one, from the very beginning, regardless of the horror, a guy is shot. We don't know at the time he's dead, but another guy who shoots himself in the head. That's well handled, too. The camera's panning, and you don't actually see it happen, but you hear the gunshot, and you know he's done it. And then fairly soon after, when we meet Cole, we learn he's got ESP.
Actually, we wait a long time to find that out.
Well, I guess when he says, I see dead people, so we really do know that. But
that's almost an hour into the film.
That's true, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, they really drag it out. And that's like a gutsy thing for Shyamalan to get away with right there.
Let's get back to the whole dead alive thing with Bruce Willis's character and the technicals of it. I was reading online that in the scene where they go to Misha Barton's room, and there's a good scare there too. The camera's wide. Cole's looking around in the center. The hand comes out to grab him. But of course, she's a benevolent ghost, and she just wants him to find out what the truth is, which of course the father has to find her right then and there in the party. That's a little bit clunky the way they do that. That mother's vicious. I mean, you're killing off your kid. But anyway, that's a whole... Actually, that's one of those examples of a kind of a Pulp Fiction sort of thing. As good as his main story is, let's go find out what's going on with these people. She's killing off her daughters as the younger one next. Maybe not now. She's going to go to jail, probably. But it says online about how when Cole opens the door, you see a shadow extending into the room, and you don't see Malcolm's shadow, even though he's right behind him. So I was looking when we watched this very closely to see if you do see shadows in general of them. One of the key moments where he blatantly is there, and they could have hidden this if they wanted to, but maybe they realized it would have given the game away, is in the scene where he does a magic trick with a penny. His reflection is on the table, and you also see his shadows plenty there. They don't even try to hide the fact that he actually is in the room. Obviously, that would spoil the twist. Does it bother you knowing this movie is set up for that one big moment at the end? Because obviously it is. As good as the domestic drama is, that's what this movie is about in the end. That when you read online about how carefully they tried to make it so Bruce Willis wouldn't show up as shadow and all that kind of stuff, you're not supposed to notice that. That if you look in that scene, he's there. You can't miss the fact that he's reflecting the table and in the windows and all this other stuff.
No, doesn't bother me. So they weren't perfect. So they fudged things here and there. Every single movie does this in one way or another. If it's good enough, you're not going to notice it. And I didn't notice it. You're reading things online, and people who have the time and inclination to nitpick about movies pick on every single detail. If that's how you're noticing it, then that's not really the filmmaker's fault, I'd say.
And that's also a reason to watch this movie multiple times in the theaters back in 1999 and help it make that much more money, because people want to know, wait a minute, how come I didn't know that? I can't believe that. Bob, did you see that? Well, we gotta go back next week!
But I think caring about little details like that, especially when the movie's good enough that it doesn't matter when you're watching it the first or second time around, you want to ruin the movie for yourself? That's actively trying to spoil it.
Part of the fun, I guess, too. One of the key things that Shyamalan does, technically as well, along with the shadows thing, for the most part that gets rid of with Bruce Willis, is that red, kind of like yellow in Jaws is a key color, or red in Sixth Sense is a key color. And that signifies the dead are about to interact with Cole. The red fort he sets up, the blanket.
Yeah, the balloon
is red.
Goes upstairs at the birthday party. The doorknob when Malcolm is mad that he can't get into that room, unbeknownst to him, it's surrounded by books.
And there's a key line, as famous as I See Dead People is, more important than the plot is Cole's line, that ghosts only see what they want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And when you play back the movie in your head and see that Malcolm couldn't have got downstairs if he was a real person, because the door is blocked off with that table that his wife has set up because he's not alive anymore, and that basement was for him. And interestingly, by the way, that in most ghost stories, basements or cellars are where ghosts tend to be.
Yeah.
Now, he's not haunting her, certainly not deliberately, but there he is down in the cellar. She's blocked it off. He only sees what he wants to see. So when he reaches and jiggles that door handle, if the camera pans down even a little bit, you're going to see that table with the books blocking it. So that's one of the better misleads, that it's just about where the camera is placed. And when they have the dinner, and she says nothing to him except at the end, happy anniversary, Malcolm. Because I didn't buy that she was mad at him, which is one of the reasons I was convinced I was right, that he was dead all along. When he reaches for the check, but he times it just so that she's pulling it away, and he sits down, but he doesn't move the chair, because of course he can't move the chair. If he does, again, that gives the game away, because she would see that. What's going on? Why is that chair moving across from me? Pretty well directed. I know I said this about Shyamalan, and I think it was The Godfather, because he reveres that movie, and he said the reason why it's his favorite is because he thinks the most important thing a director can do is control the tone, and he thinks Coppola controlled the tone in The Godfather movies as well as any other film has ever been done. He hasn't always succeeded in his own movies as well with the tone as he maybe could have. This one is probably the best example of it, even though Unbreakable I think is a better movie, and Signs to me is the most effective movie that he's ever made. But what do you think about the tone when it comes to the fact that it's this quiet domestic drama with occasional scares, and at the end you've got healing. You've got the kid bonding with his mother and revealing, I've got this special power, with a really nice use of it, too. Grandma said, every day, what did you ask her? Were you proud of me?
Oh, I really love that scene. That's Toni Collette right there. I love her as an actress in that scene. I found so genuinely moving. That's the last time you see them in the movie. That's the wrap-up of their story, because you believe in that moment that Cole is going to be okay. And like you asked what I think about these elements, whether it be the cleverness of the twist or the scares, the twist, those are like embellishments on a good story about a lonely, troubled boy that needs help and a lonely, troubled man that comes and helps him.
And can just drift off into the whiteness and go away.
But that's like a kind of an irrelevant detail. It makes it cool. It makes the movie more interesting. All those things. But to me, the real core of the movie is their relationship with each other and Colt's relationship with his mother. One of my favorite scenes in the movie is this almost throwaway scene when Cole and his mom, Lynn, are shopping and he's sitting in the shopping cart and the camera's low and she's pushing him and it's just kind of sunny day. She just decides to like goof around and have fun with them and joke around with him, and he smiles and there's this enormous relief because he's such a sad, serious kid. It's a really pretty visual representation of their relationship as a mother and son, and she loves him so much, and he's gonna soften up to her, and that's why he's gonna be okay, because she's a good mom, because he's a good kid, and because they're gonna look after each other, even after Malcolm has moved on to the next world, which thank God they didn't bother showing us, because we did not need like a big ghost finale there.
Yeah, he's gone, and that's good. But I do ask this question about the good mom, Lynn. Why doesn't Lynn take Cole to a living psychologist?
Because she has two jobs already. She can't afford to.
Well, when you consider the movie suggests that Malcolm is with this kid all the time, but he wasn't really. Another well-directed scene is when the kid comes home, and Malcolm's sitting there with his mother, but they aren't saying anything to each other because she's not seeing anybody across from her. She's just sitting there thinking. Mm-hmm. And then, as you pointed out, he does speak, actually. Cole does talk to him towards the end of the scene, but early on it's this whole game. If you take a step forward, I'm right. Take a step backwards, I'm wrong. So therefore the kid doesn't talk to him, so the mother doesn't hear anything. Why would she think anything's up?
What's probably more surprising is not that she doesn't catch on to what's going on there. More like she lets him go on his little Scooby-Doo adventures, presumably by himself.
He takes himself.
Yeah. As far as she knows, he's just taking a bus across Philadelphia to go to a strange girl's funeral.
Or to hang out at church by himself.
Yeah, exactly. He's so unsupervised.
At least when he's in school with Malcolm a few times, that's the place he'd be anyway. But yeah, it's one of those things that probably doesn't hold up, but the Hitchcock answer, you know.
We've and he's a latchkey kid. She has two jobs. It was also 99 and not this crazy helicopter parent. Kids get arrested for not having their parents around even when they're 10 years old.
And maybe she's only seeing what she wants to see.
Oh my which God, is true is for Lynn a ghost no. too?
But that line is true for a lot of non-dead people, too, who only see what they want to see. In fact, we all do that sometimes. But speaking of families, getting back to Malcolm and Anna, the Olivia Williams character, they play it early on that he's spending all this time doing his job with these kids. Yet again, a Hollywood lecture. Family playing second fiddle to an important job is not an insult, especially from people who spend 16 hours a day for months on end making these movies to lecture to us, spend time with your family!
But the truth is that Olivia's not upset with him for spending so much time. She's very proud of him and his career.
Which is what doesn't hold up when the whole thing is played out later. She's mad at him.
But then it's okay, because it all makes sense at the end. Then you get it.
Yeah.
Well, you're so nitpicky about this movie.
Because if you pull out the threads, it kind of falls apart. Except then again, we're agreeing that the family dramas work pretty damn well. I asked you a few minutes ago about tone, and you didn't really answer that question. Do you think that Shyamalan controls his tone
on this movie? Yeah, okay, absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Especially considering the silliness of the premise. And he keeps it pretty serious. He does a good job of keeping it very grounded.
Yeah. You like Toni Collette so much, and she wasn't in any other really huge movies and certainly not starring roles, but I do like her in About a Boy as the weird mother of another kooky kid, outcast kid, and then Little Miss Sunshine with that whole kooky group.
Probably her best role she ever had and one of the best roles for an actor ever was on television in United States of Terror. I don't think you saw that, but she played somebody with multiple personalities in a way that I don't think very many actors could have possibly pulled off. She was one of those cases where you could tell exactly which character she was at any given time, no matter what she was wearing or what the circumstances were.
Okay. Olivia Williams playing Anna. She seemed destined for big things after Rushmore and this movie, but then really didn't have those.
Yeah.
Very lovely, pretty good performances in both movies. Kind of petered out. She's still working, but no big performances after this one. Misha Barton, though, who does play that young dead girl, great scare in the movie, went on to pretty good things. What was it, The O.C.?
Was that the TV show she was in?
And then Shyamalan himself, always cast himself as the doctor in this movie. His parents were doctors, so that seems appropriate. Like I said, they released the movie on his birthday, They made the movie in Philadelphia, and it's set in Philadelphia. And this is the guy that did have that great trilogy, Sixth Sense, Unbreakable Signs. And then a lot of dog vomit.
Yeah, he fell apart. He's one of those cases of someone who's an egomaniacal, delusions of grandeur. There's some materials out there that kind of illustrate just exactly the kind of, I don't want to say crazy, but there is something a little off about him. He seems to be delusional. He made this fake documentary that suggested that he himself was possessed of some supernatural gifts and even cast fake fans to hang out outside his mansion. And then there was this book written about the struggle that he had to make Lady in the Water called The Man Who Heard Voices, or How M. Night Shyamalan Risked His Career on a Fairy Tale. And the book is meant to be sympathetic, but instead apparently portrays this fragile, delusional egomaniac. He's made a lot of bombs, he's made a lot of terrible movies, but it is part of the reason why he didn't become like another bland Hollywood director, which may have made him a happier person. But
I want to see The Visit. It had to be on video at this point because we didn't see it in the theater, but that looked like a weird, not throwback to this exactly, but a horror movie that maybe could have been interesting and definitely very strange, with the grandparents being a sinister source. Or are they? I don't really know. I don't know the twist in that one, whether the grandparents really are scary.
It's the first movie he's made in a long time that's gotten decent reviews. He managed to accomplish the rather difficult to pull off 6% rating on Rotten Tomatoes for The Last Airbender. So this is a guy who the critics have no reason to be sympathetic towards him at this point.
Even a 30 would have been good. He would have quintupled his success. Well, in The Sixth Sense, he starts to do something he really does well in Unbreakable, and that's using reflective surfaces to shoot things, probably in homage to people like Spielberg, who would use unusual ways to shoot things. And Spielberg was doing that even more around the same time in AI, which Haley Joel Osment is so great in, where you've got things obstructing the view a lot of the time, or it's this strange kind of camera angle, to the strange kind of reflection as well. There's also a few times where Shyamalan and his cinematographer Tak Fujimoto are using an in-camera pan and scan. The scene where Lynn and Cole are arguing about the bumblebee pendant, where he explains the grandmother is moving it towards the end of the film. But in that scene, he won't admit what's really going on. There's no cut. The camera is going from her to him, and not in a full two shot, but it's a left-handed shot of her and then a right-handed shot of him, and the camera's moving the whole time. It's an interesting technique to do that. And I said a few times, I'm forgetting what the other time was, but I know he did it more than once in this movie, and I tip my hat to find interesting ways to shoot a film and to do it in a wonder, as they say. He, of course, wrote The Sixth Sense. He writes almost all of his own movies, and not always to the best effect. You mentioned Lady in the Water a minute ago. I remember an EW article on this way back when, where he met with executives, and they said, it isn't very good. They were probably more polite than I would be to say it's just dog crap. But he seemed like he was entitled, well, so what? I should get to make it anyway. And even The Village, which was stupid, and I read a review online about that movie, which I had fun writing. I thought that movie was so dumb and so bad. But it did have elements that freaked me out a little bit at the time. I'll give it that. You would think that the success he had, he'd get to make wherever he wanted, but then again, there is a limit.
Yeah, he went to quite a bit of trouble to make that movie exactly the way he wanted it, rather than listening to the criticism of these studio heads that he had worked with. Disney made all his other films, right?
I think so, yeah.
And it didn't work out for him. I'm sure that plenty of people were thrilled that his hubris didn't pay off.
He's the best example of somebody who needs a producer.
Yes, yeah.
To guide him, and Lucas needed this back in
the day.
George
Lucas syndrome.
And they didn't have any more exactly. And then you need somebody sometimes to tell you, this idea is good, that idea is not so good, that one's got potential, that one's bad, let's move on from all of that and make this work better. His producers were Frank Marshall, who's done so many great movies, but of course he produced Raiders of the Lost Ark on the Top 100 project. Kathleen Kennedy produced E.T. with Spielberg, and now she runs Lucasfilm, so she's a huge player. The two of them worked with Spielberg on plenty of movies, really, but those are the two red letter films in particular. And then Barry Mendel, who worked on Rushmore the year before this. Sam Mercer, who was an executive producer and worked on just about everything Shyamalan's ever done, so he's been an enabler to a certain extent, too. Okay, technically, the movie is 185:1. We watched it on Netflix, just like we did with Titanic, because our DVD, I could tell you for sure, would not look as good as that. The cinematographer is Tak Fujimoto. He did shoot The Silence of the Lambs for us way back when, and he also did do Signs with Shyamalan a couple of years later. The editor, Andrew Monshine, he cut What's He Done Gilbert Great Before This and Chocolat After, so obviously working with Lasse Hallström a lot. The movie was nominated for the editing. You're an editor. Any thoughts on that?
The pacing is great. I think they obviously did a great job.
Solidly under 2 hours, too, which is rare for us the last little while. Well, Toy Story and Fargo were, but a lot of epics in the 90s so far, including the last two, Titanic and Saving Private Ryan. And the music was James Newton Howard, who's got a great resume. The Fugitive, King Kong, with Peter Jackson a few years after this, and The Dark Knight. He was involved along with Hans Zimmer, I think, as well on that. So, the influence. Well, this movie is inspired by Carnival of Souls and its similarly big twist. We recently saw that, right before Halloween, in fact. That one's a little transparent. But then you guessed the twist, even though you've never seen the movie before. Maybe because it came before movies like this. Had you seen this movie in the 60s in the theaters, maybe you would have been blown away the way people were in 1962 when that came out.
Mm-hmm.
And you thought the movie was fine, but you...
Yeah, it was fine.
But she was dead all along.
Yeah.
Oh my god, Carnival of Souls is ruined for people now.
Oh, I promise that if you haven't seen it before, you would have figured it out too. Yeah,
that's true. Big influence, twist endings, especially in Shyamalan's own movies. And he tried to shoehorn them in there a little bit too much, maybe. Unbreakable. People have often criticized a good movie for the fact that Sam Jackson's character was a bad guy all along. But that is set up pretty well, and I'll give them that. The twist in The Village is terrible, but it worked for him for a couple years at least, with the big twists. And this one mega success has kept Shyamalan working despite the duds we keep talking about. They probably will always say, that's the guy who made that movie. We got to find the success. He can do it again. He made Coke once. He can make Coke for us again. The last influence I've got is the I see dead people line has been parodied endlessly, even to this day.
I think probably a lot of ghost movies got greenlit for the next few years after Sixth Sense came out. And it's been credited with influencing even stuff like Paranormal Activity, where you have this kind of domestic ghost movie.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think it was 10 years later. That was also found footage. So Blair Witch, that's another movie from 1999.
Oh, Blair Witch!
Maybe not a great movie, but talk about influential. Blair Witch Project is up there with most movies of the last 20 years as far as being influential. We wouldn't have Paranormal Activity and so many other found footage movies had it not been for that one.
They've invented a genre. I wouldn't say it's a great movie, but man, you cannot deny that it blew up Hollywood a little bit there.
Okay, the AFI and Oscar list for The Sixth Sense versus the Oscars. 6 nominations, but no wins. Best Picture up against American Beauty. Best Director for Shyamalan. He lost that one to also American Beauty. Supporting Actor, Haley Joel Osment. Mentioned that Michael Caine won that. Supporting Actress for Toni Collette. The Screenplay and the Editing. This movie is not being preserved in the National Film Registry. Maybe it never will be. And the two other AFI lists. 60th on the Top 100 Thrills. And I See Dead People was 44th in the top 100 quotes, and I could see that it'd even been higher than that, but 44th is still pretty highly ranked, I would say. So, we talked so much about horror films on the list because we had so few of them, and we're both fans, especially me. Of the three we had on the list, Frankenstein, Psycho, and this one, you just said this one didn't really scare you, but which one do you find to be the most effective horror film, whether it actually scared you when we saw it for the project or not?
Oh, so for scares, Sixth Sense is the scariest. I mean, Psycho is head and shoulders the best movie of those three, but it didn't really scare me. Sixth Sense definitely spooks me.
And we already said at the top of the project, this movie does not belong on the list, despite the fact it was financially successful and it was influential. But that's not quite enough. I've made the argument that a movie that just has great influence could be enough for this list, but this one didn't have enough of that, I wouldn't say. And it's still so modern. Blade Runner's influence could be enough for that. That's also 17 years before this movie came out. It had so much more time to influence literal culture. And that also didn't make the first list. It was time for a make-good of sorts for Blade Runner. Okay, well, we've only got one more movie to cover in the whole list anyway. We'll talk about the 90s when we do the wrap-up. But briefly, 13 movies in this great decade, one of my favorite decades of movies. Your favorite, I guess, is Pulp Fiction, right?
Actually, my favorite is Goodfellas.
I don't think any of the movies we've covered in the 90s have been bad. This is the weakest choice of all of them, I think.
Titanic?
Well, the last two have plenty of faults. Titanic, Saving Private Ryan. But the influence and all the other things that they had, when we discussed those, the many AFI lists and all that other stuff, put it over the top. This one's under the shade of that stuff a little bit too much. I don't know if I can pick one movie like the most from the 90s. I'm looking at your little list of appearances.
It's hard, yeah, there's Fargo and Toy Story.
That whole run, there's nothing I didn't like in that. Fargo, Toy Story, Forrest Gump, Shawshank, Pulp Fiction, Schindler's List, Unforgiven, Silence of the Lambs, Dance with Wolves even, and of course Goodfellas. Man. Okay, we'll talk about this when we do the wrap-up. It's only 2 weeks away anyway. So up last on the Top 100 Project is our final AFI picture. Yep, the project comes to an end with our 123rd movie, Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. And the coming attractions trivia. Lord of the Rings had, of course, two sequels. How many sequels released in the 2000s were nominated for the 2007 Top 100?
Oh my god, that's hard. Okay, for the answer to that, tune in to next week's podcast. If you'd like more trivia from Ryan and me, along with all kinds of other fun stuff, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can find both Ryan and me on Twitter. My handle is @BevEllisEllis and Ryan is @MovieFiend51. But if you'd like to message us privately, we'd love to hear from you guys. Send us an email. Our address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
So what is the seventh sense?
And cut.
No, really, what is it? Are you good at your taxes? Is that what it is?